The American Counseling Association's 2014 podcast series. Today we are speaking with John Duggan about Bipolar Resiliency Program Group and Individual Therapy in the Private Practice Setting. John P. Duggan is a graduate of Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia, with an MA in Counseling, and of the Washington Theological Union in Washington, D.C. with an MA in Theology. He is a licensed clinical professional counselor and a nationally certified counselor with a private practice in Silver Spring, Maryland. In addition to his clinical practice, John provides training and support to other counselors in areas of compliance, e-communication and telehealth, workflow management, and private practice development. Welcome, John Duggan.
Hi, Rebecca. Good to be with you.
Thank you. I'm going to dive into the questions, and the first one is, how did you get interested in helping clients with bipolar spectrum disorder?
Oh, yeah, that was really an interesting process for me. I was working in a private practice and was noticing that a series of clients that I had been working with just weren't improving at the rate I would expect them to. And then there were some other things that I started to notice. Springtime would come, and all of a sudden, it would be this burst of energy, and some clients would say, oh, I'm fine, I'm all done, and I'm done with therapy. And then some other folks would be trying some different medications throughout the year. They may be antidepressants. They may have been put on some steroid medication for pain or inflammation, and the mood would just expand and sometimes go up to hypomanic or manic. And so it became very clear to me that folks who may have been showing up for an adjustment or referred by their psychiatrist for depression were actually presenting with a different form of a mood disorder, the bipolar spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I also was working in the emergency room as a psychiatric crisis clinician and had a lot of experience, hands-on, face-to-face clinical experience with folks who were in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And decided that I really needed to hone my assessment skills and try to find ways that could help people who were perhaps coming in with one diagnosis to do work with counseling and were actually presenting with a different form of a mood disorder, more in the bipolar spectrum. And so I put on my researcher hat and just said, you know what, I've got to find some other techniques that are going to be helpful to work with these clients.
What are the most helpful treatment techniques for bipolar spectrum disorder?
For most people, the mainstay will be at some point medication management. Now, naturally, that is something that is going to be worked out with and managed by a psychiatrist, a neurologist, or some other prescriber. But commonly, medication is going to be part of the treatment plan at some point during a person's life. In terms of therapy, in terms of things that a mental health counselor would offer, interpersonal and social rhythm therapy is a very, very well-researched and a strong clinical intervention that can help folks. Family-focused psychoeducation. Some cognitive behavioral and dialectical behavioral therapy interventions can be helpful, but that really depends, Rebecca, on where a person is. So it's kind of mood congruent when you want to use some of those interventions. And then finally, there's group psychoeducation therapy. And one model that's out there that has been very, very helpful is called the Barcelona psychoeducational model.
Well, let's start with the interpersonal and social rhythms therapy. Tell us a little about that. What is that?
Sure. I actually discovered that because my training focused on relationship-oriented and interpersonal therapy. That's kind of my primary theoretical orientation.
Mm-hmm.
And interpersonal and social rhythms therapy focuses on daily routines. And the presupposition is that stabilizing healthy daily routines, so sleep cycle, planning kind of a work, rest, day schedule, developing social rhythms in terms of relationships, that's going to be the mainstay of helping folks who have bipolar spectrum or a general medical condition that looks like a bipolar disorder to gain a sense of stability. And the focus of interpersonal and social rhythm therapy, as I understand it, is to really look at the bidirectional relationship between an individual's mood and interpersonal events, so day-to-day activities that they encounter, whether they're going to the grocery store, relating with a loved one in their family, taking time to rest or engage in work or things like that. Those experiences are going to impact the person's mood and stress level. Another one is to use some of the different techniques to improve interpersonal functioning. So if one of our listeners has been trained in dialectical behavioral therapy, a lot of those skills are going to be helpful in this type of therapy to help somebody just kind of expand their repertoire to kind of relate with other people and manage stress. Also, stabilizing routines, and here is such a crucial factor for the interpersonal and social rhythm therapy, is paying attention to sleep hygiene. We really want to look at those sleep-wake cycles and make sure that somebody's getting good quality sleep, because one of the thoughts behind this type of therapy is that improving the sleep-wake cycle, making sure that somebody is well-rested, is ultimately going to promote mood stability. And then, of course, we focus on medication management and helping people hear. And the last thing that often gets skipped, I think, with folks who are experiencing bipolar spectrum is grieving for the lost sense of healthy self. We all have these hopes and dreams for ourselves, and sometimes when a person may be in their 20s or 30s or 40s, gets diagnosed and has to enter into treatment, there is this whole paradigm shift, this whole change in one's personal identity. And sometimes there's a lot of grief that goes around with how their life has changed.
When you mentioned stabilizing daily routines, sleep-wake cycles, improving medication adherence, the improving medication adherence, you know, I used to work in an inpatient maximum security psychiatric hospital, and I can't tell you how many bipolar clients came in because they had decided to go off their medication. How do you deal with that?
Well, this is the value of the interpersonal therapy approach, because you're able to align with the client. And as a counselor, I don't sit with a prescription pad. You know, I do a lot of education to say, this is the scope of my practice. This is what I can do. I can educate you on this. But it's your choice in terms of whether or not you continue with the medication. But let's consider that what often will happen is you'll start to take some of these medicines. You may have some side effects. We may need to work with your doc to tweak them. But oftentimes what happens is you'll reach a point where things feel better. They feel different. And what then will happen is somebody will say, you know what, this is kind of like having bronchitis. My infection's cleared up. I don't need this stuff anymore. That's when folks will stop taking their medicine. And so I really integrate a lot of the education and resiliency and encouraging and validating the client to ask them to consider that this is a longer-term treatment plan that we have, that as the goal is for them to feel different, to feel better, perhaps euthymic or more stable, and once we achieve that, then they need to continue to hang in there with those medications for a much longer period of time. One of the struggles, though, and it relates to outcomes, is whether or not an individual has insight into the course of their mood disorder, the bipolar disorder. And if an individual has an awareness, they understand, they can kind of grasp what's going on and what can happen if they stop treatment, that usually makes it more likely that they're going to adhere with it.
I know some clients have said to me over the years, I miss the manic phase. They never say they miss the depressive phase, but they will say, I miss the manic phase. So I like the idea of maybe grieving for that, you know, that is not going to work out for you, too, you know, and kind of grieving for that. I like that idea. You also mentioned the Barcelona model. Well, please tell us about that.
Yeah, the Barcelona model, it's a psychoeducation program that is an hour and a half per session, and it goes for 21 group sessions. It is
wow.
An incredible process.
Mm-hmm.
When I would pitch the idea to some of my clients, everybody looked at me and said, are you kidding me? There is no way that I can commit to 21 sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I needed to do was to distill the wisdom from that and find a way to implement the concepts, the education, the support mm-hmm. in the private practice setting. And so that's how I developed, at the time, what I called the Bipolar Resiliency Program.
Mm-hmm.
Combined individual and group sessions. To help clients, you know, with kind of the counseling portion of their wellness plan, their treatment plan.
Mm-hmm. Maybe if you could talk a little about the outcomes of the Bipolar Resiliency Program and anything about the Bipolar Resiliency Program. I think there are lots of our members who are listening who would be interested in trying this.
Yeah. The first thing I would offer is to maybe to a clinician who is feeling skeptical or, gosh, I don't know if I could really work with somebody with bipolar disorder, I would say, gosh, trust your clinical instincts. You most likely have the wisdom to help folks who are functioning on a day-to-day basis to be able to live healthy and productive lives. So don't let a little bit of fear, you know, limit your clinical scope. But I would say, you know, in terms of having individual sessions, it's practical support. It's recognizing that a client may come on one week and feel a certain mood that's kind of down or depressed, and that they could mm-hmm. often come the next week and actually be a little more elevated or distracted, or you got to be able to kind of go with the flow.
Mm-hmm.
But offering the practical support, psychoeducation, I found over time, usually within about 6 months, if somebody has really just been diagnosed and is starting on medications, we can increase stability, promote treatment adherence, and help them improve with their relationships, you know, whether it's a marriage or dating or friendships or in the workplace. Working to make some of those changes so that they can, you know, really become more effective and take care of themselves. In a year's time that I did both a group and an individual counseling sessions, I would say that between 8 to 10 people that were participating, everybody had at one point been hospitalized. Everyone mm-hmm. was on medication, and what happened over the course of that year was remarkable. Stable moods, improved daily functioning, relationships were good, there were no emergency room visits, no hospitalizations, mm-hmm. And treatment adherence actually went up, and feeling in the group setting, feeling as though clients were safe because they could come in and kind of, as one person put it, I can just let my hair down. I can be who I am and say, this is what I'm struggling with. And when I put it out there, members of the group get it. I feel heard and validated. And that was just so powerful to see. And I think it really does change people's lives.
It really does sound powerful. Let me ask you, when you do an assessment to decide whether or not somebody is appropriate for this group, what kind of things are you looking for?
Well, doing what is commonly would be called a mood disorder assessment and working with a person's history, you have to really carefully go back and find out, you know, when maybe they first had their first experience of depression. people will tend to underreport experiences of mood elevation because most people don't see that as a problem. It's actually kind of, like you said, it's kind of enjoyed. I might get it. And so you've really got to be empathetic and creative in asking those questions to get a good history. There are some co-occurring conditions that'll happen, though. It's common for folks who have bipolar spectrum disorder to also have panic, social anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder. And sometimes people who have gone through an adverse experience and develop PTSD will actually have pre-existing signs and symptoms of a mood disorder or bipolar disorder prior to that trauma. And I've often seen people who will go through a traumatic event and all of a sudden, boom, that's when the bipolar manifests and gets diagnosed for the first time, and they're also struggling with PTSD. There's also some obsessive compulsive traits that will show up as well as ADHD. And so really doing some careful investigative work and sometimes working with a psychologist, too, to get an assessment.
Do you usually have a co-facilitator in these groups?
I did not. I wanted to, but the realities of being in private practice just made it so that it was really hard to get a co-facilitator to be able to come at the same time and negotiate all that. But I often will work very closely with the primary care physician and also with a psychiatrist or a nurse practitioner who's prescribing medication.
Well, you talked a little about co-occurring. Do you have anything to say about differential diagnoses?
Yeah. I mentioned earlier the importance of the sleep cycle with the interpersonal and social rhythm therapy. And one of the big things is to really do some research and learning about what a person presents when they actually could be having some sleep disorders, some sleep apnea. Now, we're not, as counselors, we're not diagnosing that. But there are different types of questionnaires and assessments that are out there where you can learn to start asking those questions. And if somebody presents with issues that correlate with a possible sleep concern, sleep apnea, you want to refer them to their primary care doctor and to sleep medicine. I've had several cases where actually some people will have co-occurring, so it's sleep apnea and bipolar spectrum, but other people have been misdiagnosed with bipolar when actually it was a sleep disorder, and once the mood stabilized, they were doing much, much better. They got off the medicines and they were, functioning with a CPAP machine, for example. And then the other areas to look at are, medications or substances. Sometimes a person could take prednisone from their primary care for inflammation, and that can trigger a first-time manic or hypomanic experience.
Oh, that's interesting.
I've had cases where somebody is told from their physician to take 100 milligrams of Benadryl. And that, that is something that could... So you really have to be attentive to the substances that a person's using, not only substances that would be, like alcohol, amphetamines and pot or something like that, but also substances that would be common ones that, people might take for a cold or for an allergy. In some cases, that can actually trigger a mood swing and bring on an onset of the bipolar disorder.
I don't think I realized how important the sleep cycle is, and I do think of many many times when we had somebody come in the hospital who was on the bipolar spectrum that they would want to pace the floors instead of sleeping. What other physical things might we see in terms of the differential diagnoses?
Well, this is where it can also get kind of creative. There can be some general medical issues. Sometimes people who have been diagnosed and treated for advanced Lyme disease can actually have some of the symptoms that look, or signs that look as though it's the bipolar spectrum. And it's usually much more diffuse, but what happens after the Lyme has been treated, the person could still experience some neurological and emotional and behavioral health problems that mimic or that look like it's this type of a mood disorder. If someone's had a head trauma, I often also will ask folks about endocrine issues such as thyroid or diabetes, and refer them to their primary care doctor for, you know, a really good physical and lab workup. And then there are some more complex cases where someone with lupus or multiple sclerosis, epilepsy, and even sodium imbalances can present in the therapist's office as looking like a cycling mood disorder when actually it's a medical condition. And so you really want to work hand-in-hand with primary care.
This is that's the beauty of integrated care, is we need to see more of this working hand-in-hand with primary care physicians, particularly the ones you mentioned, Lyme disease, lupus, multiple sclerosis. These seem to be diagnoses that are hard to make. So, you know, there's a lot of the primary care physician experimenting with different things. So I could see how somebody might present on bipolar spectrum while they're trying to figure that out.
And it's really scary and frustrating for the client, too.
It is, and some people think they're malingering, right?
Yeah.
What about prognosis? What's the prognosis?
I think earlier interventions are going to present a better prognosis than if somebody waits and goes longer. So being really encouraging and also assertive at the same time to help somebody engage in treatment. We know that insight into the disorder, those who have an insight into it and can be aware of their mood changes, notice the stressors, the triggers, can acknowledge that, you know, this is something that's happening in their life and needs treatment. Insight into the disorder is a profound variable that's going to improve the likelihood of good outcomes. And we need to remember that there's actually, you know, part of some of these conditions where folks don't have insight into the disorder, and it's not necessarily a choice or, you know, part of where they're saying, you know, I just don't want treatment. It actually may be the disorder itself which is making insight difficult or impossible. And so being empathetic to that possibility. And finally, I think engaging family, friends, social support, that also makes the outcomes and the prognosis much stronger. What we know is that if there is family involved, a loved one, a friend, and if there are empathic people in one's life, that's going to actually promote the social rhythms and promote the likelihood of treatment adherence and staying engaged, and that brings about a better outcome.
Are these groups more psychoeducationally oriented, or are they more insight oriented, or both?
It's both, Rebecca. I like to integrate both the psychoeducation to help people, you know, get a little something, get a little takeaway message, but then to a degree to offer, you know, mutual support as well as some insight. They would not necessarily go to the degree of insight as, you know, an interpersonal psychodynamic group might be, because for some people, if, you know, depending on where the mood is, if you start doing too much exploration into the interpersonal stuff and some psychodynamic techniques, that can actually be overwhelming and destabilize. So seeking some insight, but, you know, not pressuring somebody to go too far, too deep in the group setting at times is appropriate. And maybe suggesting, you know, hey, let's bring that to individual therapy. Let's talk about it there. And I find that that offers a sense of stability and cohesion. It helps people.
I understand you've synthesized psychoeducational techniques to help clients with treatment adherence. Can you tell us a little more about that? I think treatment adherence is so important. So talk a little about these techniques you've developed.
Sure. This comes from the Barcelona psychoeducational model, and I came up with this acronym called SMART. S-M-A-R-T. Now, what I'm presenting today in our conversation is for clinicians, so I've added a few extra things, but I try to make it as simple as possible for clients so that, you know, and oftentimes they'll look at me and they'll smile and go, oh, okay, SMART, and they'll go down through the acronym and pick out the certain things that they need to focus on. So I've expanded it a little bit today, but the goal is to take those 21 topics, you know, the Barcelona model, and put them into a way that I could just bring into individual therapy or group sessions.
I love the SMART idea because, you know, that helps people. It triggers them to remember each part of it. So, yeah, explain that to us. What SMART means.
Sure. The S, and this is the clinician's version.
Okay.
Stands for safety, stress, structure, sleep, substances, and season. I know it's a lot. We need to do risk assessments. If somebody has ever been suicidal, we need to be able to go through on each visit and assess for their safety. Suicide, homicide, any other type of high-risk behaviors, impulsivity that could leave a person in a dangerous situation, we need to always be assessing that. So safety, stress, that's fundamental to the interpersonal and social rhythm treatment, is to help people understand what their stressors are and how to better manage them. And it can be as simple as, you know, it doesn't have to be like I'm having stress at my workplace because this big assignment is coming up. Sure, that can be a stressor, but skipping a meal, not sleeping appropriately, that can create physiological stress. And so often, you know, some folks will start to focus on a project and all of a sudden they skip breakfast and lunch. So that's going to create some stress on your body, which could actually, for some people, trigger a mood affective switch. And so I want to teach people again and again how to manage their stress and how to take care of themselves. Structure, putting together a daily routine, having something to look forward to. You know, if somebody is working and they may be going through, let's say, this time of year could be a depressive phase, they may have from Monday through Friday kind of a structure. So, you know, I get my coffee, I leave the house, I get on the train, I get into work. That provides structure. I get home, X, Y, and Z happens. But then the weekend comes, and the weekend presents this vast open of nothing. Nothing's planned.
Right.
And that's where structure starts to fade away. And so what I'll do then is say, okay, let's create some sort of a routine for your weekend so that you're also having stability, so that by the time Monday rolls around again, you're still feeling resilient and confident. So one of the basic things I start with is every Saturday and Sunday morning, I want for you to get up, get a shower, follow your morning routine, whether it's, you know, get some OJ or take a doggy out for a walk. Lace up your shoes. Put your shoes on and actually tie them, because what that's telling me is that I'm going to leave the house. And then have some sort of activity planned in the morning. It doesn't have to be elaborate. It may be walking the dog. It may be going out and getting a cup of tea or coffee, doing something that gets you out so that then the rest of your day can start to flow. You can think of a couple of other things you'd like to do. So there's an example of structure and how that applies. Sleep, we've talked about that.
Yeah.
Substances, whether it's, you know, alcohol, whether it's somebody who's going for amphetamines to bring their mood up and that can lead to destabilization. It may be substances such as they go to a specialist who prescribes herbs or puts together an herbal remedy. It's like, we want to be careful. We want to look at those things that we're taking in so that we can get an accurate assessment of what's happening with the mood. And then the seasonal component. Quite often there's going to be a seasonal change. And, you know, Rebecca, when I'm working with these clients, I will start preparing them for the time change in October, where the clock goes back an hour. I'll start preparing them in August.
You know, I had a private practice in Oregon, and you really learn about seasonal changes when you have a private practice in Oregon, because it's gray. And I used to think, oh, seasonal affective disorder, I don't know if that's really a disorder. Well, guess what? I changed my mind in Oregon. It really is an important disorder that affects people tremendously. I like your idea of preparing them ahead of time.
It's helpful. Yeah. Especially if you've worked with them for a while, you can kind of say, you know what, I'm going to be your memory here, because a lot of people forget. And I'll look at somebody and say, you know what, right around this time of year, this has happened before. So let's plan now. And if we take these steps, we might see some good stability and resilience through the next few months. And it works. It can be very, very helpful for people.
Yes. Okay, so that's the S of SMART. What's the M?
The M is medication.
Okay.
We want to work on increasing treatment adherence. Yes, counselors do not prescribe. That's not within our scope of practice. Yet if we have a good therapeutic alliance with the client, we can do it so that, you know, we can talk with them about benefits, about the side effects, educating them about, certain things that could be going on and how they can talk with their psychiatrist or prescriber in ways that are going to be most effective.
Yes.
Preparing for that medication management appointment is essential. And so sometimes I'll do coaching with people around what is it that you want to communicate to your doctor based on what we've been working on so that your doc can then know what's going on. I think it's important for us as mental health counselors to chart this information.
Yes.
To be monitoring kind of what's going on. We're not prescribing it, but yet having an understanding of what their overall treatment plan is, I think is critical. Doing some of the assessments like the abnormal involuntary movement scale and seeing if anyone has side effects from an antipsychotic, if they've got tremors and stuff like that. That can be really helpful. Looking at the side effect profile, asking someone if they've started to gain weight, especially if they're on an atypical antipsychotic, it can be a risk for diabetes. I think also being empathic, using empathy. Many of us may never take an antipsychotic, but I think a fair number of people have either maybe needed some pain medicine or they've taken maybe a muscle relaxer and something that can leave them feeling very lethargic and tired. Just in terms of your own personal experiences, perhaps use those as a way to be empathic with a client who says, oh my gosh, I'm on this medicine and I can't think in the morning. Well, you might understand what it's like to take something that leaves you feeling really foggy and slow, and empathizing with the struggle that they're talking about.
And I think there's something about warning or discussing with clients that sometimes the medicine needs to be tweaked several times before you get it right. A lot of them don't understand that. And several times in terms of frequency or dosage, you know, whatever it is. And then when they get it right, it's going to feel right. But all of this information that they're giving their prescribers, prescriber will be very helpful in helping the prescriber to get the correct dosage, the correct frequency, the correct medication. Do you?
Absolutely. And, yeah. And I think looking at it in terms of a lifespan development, you know, mm-hmm. being honest with a client and informing them, it is more likely that you're going to, over the course of your life, need to make some forms of changes. It could be seasonal. Mm-hmm. It could be over every couple of years because, you know, well, I mean, let's face it, for men, testosterone levels are going to typically change. For women, there can be changes in estrogen and all of this. You know, it's like we're treating the whole person. And so mm-hmm. we need to get the endocrinologist involved. And so recognizing that those changes are also going to impact their medication management for the mood disorder and also kind of their, you know, their feeling of stability. And we're saying, hey, this is something that we know, and it's going to be okay. We'll find ways to kind of work through it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a sense of hope for people.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is where group therapy is so helpful, too, because somebody in the group will say, oh, that happened to me, and then my medication was changed and this happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, we have the S and the M of SMART. What's the A?
The A, advanced directive and alternative care. For someone who has gone through suicidal episodes, hospitalizations, they've gone missing, they've gone on buying or spending sprees and stuff like that, putting together an advanced directive for their behavioral health or for their psychiatric care is important. I recommend it as an option, and there are forms that are available on the internet. And what it does is it outlines, you know, here's where I would like to go if I do decompensate or
mm-hmm.
these are the medications that are helpful. These are the ones that I don't want to have prescribed. These are my healthcare providers that you should contact. It's like all of that information is pulled together. And then they share it with their therapist, their psychiatrist, and a family member, a loved one.
Yeah.
And it gets notarized. Yeah. And that way, if something happens, you can also, you know, kind of say, listen, I think that we're getting back into this gray area where we might be getting close to some trouble, and here's mm-hmm. what you've told me that you would like to do. So it's also empowering client autonomy mm-hmm. to make decisions and to remind them to say, when this happens, you've told me in your advanced directive that this is what we should do. Are you still on track with that? Do you still want to go that route? Let's talk about it. Now, of course, if somebody's in, you know, an acute phase or crisis,
mm-hmm.
You've got to take this information and you know, take steps to protect somebody and get them the appropriate mm-hmm. level of care.
Right.
But along with the advanced directive, Rebecca, is the alternative. Some folks will call it the complementary alternative medicine
mm-hmm.
route, where it could be massage by a licensed massage therapist or acupuncture. I mm-hmm. encourage people with yoga, tai chi, swimming, meditation, if those things are helpful, then bring in those alternative things and create them into your life so that you can have some social rhythms around that to help you kind of manage your stress and your moods and respect the physical dimension of how this can impact your body.
I love that. I particularly love the advanced directive because it is, you know, people often do decompensate who are on this spectrum. They will decompensate. And so to have a plan that is created by them in the event of decompensation is wonderful. I like that. Well, you mentioned alternative care, which sounds great, yoga, meditation, all that. What about herbs and supplements?
Yeah, excuse me. People can certainly take them and do fine. What I like to do is caution them. So this is more education, and this is sometimes working with, you know, a naturopath or other clinicians mm-hmm. who are on the treatment team that the client selects to to help them monitor and to look for some of these herbs or supplements. Some may be just fine, but also be aware that others may actually destabilize. They may have an interaction with the medication and could cause some problems. And so just being thoughtful and, again, monitoring and providing that support. I think this is where a mental health counselor is such a valuable player or part of the treatment team. The client is probably going to see the counselor the most frequently out of all of the other providers. So we're able to provide that continuity of care, and when things start to show up that are problematic, we can then raise up the flag and contact the prescriber or contact family. But that's also how it fits in with some of these alternative treatments in terms of birth supplements. If somebody starts taking them and then their mood destabilizes, that gives us the option to really step in and prevent the full crisis and hospitalization.
Yeah. Okay, we have the SMA of SMART. What about the R? We're getting there. It is a lot, but it's also great.
Yeah. The R is recreation. So I want to encourage people to recreate, to energize themselves in ways that is healthy for them based on their temperament and their lifestyle and all that sort of stuff. So getting out and having some time to recharge and play. Rest is another R, making sure that there's proper rest that ties back into the sleep. And then relationships. Having good, supportive relationships, that's foundational in terms of prognosis and good treatment outcomes.
One of the somebody who lives is in my neighborhood was talking to me, and she is bipolar, and you would never know. And I said, how do you never go off your medication? Because I was wondering, probably most people don't even know and wouldn't even think that she was bipolar, but she does such a good job because she doesn't go off her medication. So when you talk about relationships, she said, my husband is in charge of giving my medication. And I thought, that's not a bad idea, He, pardon me?
That's a great idea.
It's a great idea because she would want to go off. She would miss the mania and she would want to go off. And she said, he's in charge. He gives it to me every night. And so that's a relationship that's very helpful in terms of this the SMART, the R. That's a very helpful relationship. Okay, the T in SMART.
Yeah.
What is that?
The T is therapy.
Yeah.
As it's needed. There are times where people may work intensely for 6 months. They may do individual and group or 8 months, and then they hit a point where they're doing okay. That's fine. Let's put that in our treatment plan. Let's make that as part of our agreement. And then they may take 6 months off. They may, I'm doing okay. I actually have got some work assignments, and I'm doing this project at home. And I'll check back in with you in a period of time. And so the T is the therapy piece, but allowing there to be some ebbs and flows in terms of if somebody really is getting to a point where they're stabilizing, then you can taper back. You can go on a hiatus or stop treatment and, set up an agreement where if they need to resume, if there is a flare-up, that either they'll come back to work with me or that I'll refer them to another provider if that's just not possible. But what it does is it allows for that greater monitoring and stabilization as it's needed. And, the difference, Rebecca, is that if somebody is in a mood cycling, and so they're kind of going up and down, usually the therapist, we're going to know that. And you honestly give that feedback and say, gosh, I don't feel comfortable with that. I don't feel comfortable taking a break right now because we're kind of going into a season where we've been on again and off again, and mm-hmm. that usually tells me that there's some stressors and there's some need of support. And, you know, once upon a time I had a clinical supervisor who told me, when you least want to go to therapy, John, that's when you most need to be there.
Yeah. and tune-ups. Absolutely. And another thing you can add to tea is tune-ups. People need to come in every now and then so they're, you know, they think that they're fine, everything's okay, but suddenly it starts feeling you're on the precipice of things not being okay, you know. So to come in at that time for a tune-up, I think is really smart.
Mm-hmm. Great one.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah.
What have your clients who are on the bipolar spectrum, what have they taught you about the disorder?
They've helped me approach it with a great sense of humility, and also having a sense of humor. That there it is incredibly painful and difficult for both the individual and the family. But also some of the ways that they have adapted with their life when they can get through some of the really difficult and despairing moments and look back and talk about with a sense of confidence and wisdom that they have been able to grow and develop relationships, that they have had children, grandchildren. It's like all of these nice moments come along and you can celebrate them.
And
for me that is profound. I think another thing that they've taught me is that there are moments where there can be some really difficult patches, and to respect that. For example, you know, if somebody enters into a mixed mood state and it's really dysphoric, that there can be a lot of irritability and anger and lashing out. I've learned to step back in terms of the therapist's role and not personalize that and take that on, you know, as an awareness of kind of what their inner experience is like, and then be more supportive and encouraging. It's been such a delight to work with people, even in those really tight spaces.
I remember a client that taught me something. I didn't understand this need to, I really didn't know much about this need to go and buy things. She came in one morning and she brought, I think, 7 handbags, all the same handbag in 7 different colors. she said that she was in her manic phase and she just, one wasn't enough. She needed 7 of these handbags. And I thought, oh my gosh, okay. So she taught me something that day about what that was about.
I'm
going to go to our last question, which is, ACA currently has 55,000 plus members, most of whom are clinicians. Is there anything I have not asked you that you want our members to know?
Wow. I feel like we've covered so much.
We have.
There are a couple of things that come to mind for me.
Okay.
First off, one of my past experiences was director of a geropsychiatric program, and we provided in-home counseling and then psychiatric visits for homebound seniors. And so in terms of the aging population, if somebody who is an older adult who is on bipolar spectrum, being aware that the body is going to metabolize medications differently. And so for some people, the medications that they had been on for many years may not be effective, or it may be causing problems. And so just to be aware of that possibility, you know, for example, someone may have been on Klonopin to get them to sleep at night for years. Well, what can happen is that can cause, memory problems. There has been some links to dementia. And also, the way that the medication is metabolized may cause cognitive and balance problems. So my point is we're not the prescribers, but to be aware that if we're working with an aging population, that it's important sometimes to do more psychoeducation with family members and to reach out to their prescriber if we start noticing some things that are happening. Is it okay if I mention the book?
Yes, please do. And I want all of our listeners to know that there will be some links at the end of this podcast so you can click on and go and get some of these books that John Duggan has talked to us about today. Yes, tell us about the book.
Great. There's four books that I'm recommending, but two that I want to mention in our podcast.
Okay.
One is called The Prescriber's Guide. It's Stahl's Essential Psychopharmacology, and it's available in paperback. You can get it on Kindle. There's an iPad version. It is a really great go-to source to help counselors quickly learn about different medications and their side effect profile, and it's written in a clear, concise way that is, I think, going to be helpful to a lot of our listeners, regardless if they're working with bipolar spectrum or clients who have other types of medicines. Hands down, one of my common go-tos. The other one goes back to something that you had mentioned earlier in terms of relationships and this individual that you know who has her spouse reminding to take the medication. Recommending psychoeducational books to clients is it's an art. Sometimes it can be helpful, and sometimes the literature can scare the daylights out of either the client or their family members.
Yeah.
So just put that out there, that we have to use good clinical judgment. But one book that I found to be particularly helpful is called Loving Someone with Bipolar Disorder. It's written by Julie Fast, who is somebody who's out. She's public. She works. She does training and writing. And she lives with bipolar disorder. And it's co-authored by John Preston, who's a psychologist. And this book just goes through and talks about some very common dynamics that can happen in relationships and how an individual as well as her or his family members or loved one can be of support and can understand what's going on.
Is this one written more for the significant other or for the client?
I would probably say it's written for the significant other, but I found it to be very helpful for both people, both the client as well as other loved ones, to read it at the same time.
Great. Okay.
Because what it will do is, sometimes we're not necessarily doing full-blown family or couples counseling, but it can be appropriate to bring in other family members or a partner or spouse and actually use some of the themes from the book to provide more psychoeducation and support and do some brief interventions that can be really, really important. And, and it does take a willingness on the part of a loved one to really look at what's going on and understand that, I can look at this, I can be with this and be of support. Sometimes it takes 6 months to a year to get people motivated, but it works. It works.
Yes.
So those are two great resources that I like to recommend.
Okay. That's great. Well, I want to thank you so much, John Duggan, for joining us today to discuss treatment of bipolar spectrum. To view links to this program, to write to the presenter or the host, please go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Dr. Rebecca Daniel-Burke, your host for the ACA 2014 podcast series, signing off.